You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I am your host, Dr. Melody Fox, along with co-host Alan Cardoza, who finds himself overseas on a case this morning. So hopefully he'll be back with us tomorrow, or next week, I should say. As each week, we will both bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will discuss issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, interesting stories, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually healthy. Now, with both of us having 30 years experience working with families in crisis, we have both been very fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and some truly entertaining and innovative authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. As we continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring to you Answers for the Family. Now, today's guest is a wonderful author and has a very inspirational book, and our guest is Mark Shaw. He is a former criminal defense attorney. He is a newspaper publisher, a television radio personality, turned to the author of 24 books, and he's still counting. His latest book, the one we're going to be discussing today, is called Road to a Miracle, and it chronicles a spiritual journey that led him to discover a new family, a daughter, and two grandchildren he never knew existed after he had lost his previous family through a bizarre series of events involving legendary basketball coach Bobby Knight. Now, Mark lives currently in Superior, Colorado with his wife, as well as their beloved Labrador, and who's also called the Wonder Dog, I understand. So today's topic is about keeping the faith, because you never know when there's a miracle right around the corner. So Mark Shaw, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed your book, and I was going, well, you know, this isn't a book I would usually read, and I was just so thrilled once I opened it and started to read it. I couldn't put it down. I think I read 5 hours straight on Saturday.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great.
And great. I was hoping to get back to it, and to be honest, I didn't quite get to the last chapter, so I'm really excited to get there and have you talk a little bit without giving away everything.
Well, I guess we'll have to put you in suspense a little bit, and then I can fill you in on what happened, because it's a, you know, it's a gift of a lifetime, as I'll talk about.
Oh, absolutely. Now, A Road to a Miracle, what brought you to writing this particular book?
Well, most of my books are biographies. I do have a new novel coming out in January, a legal thriller that I wrote, but for the most part, it's been biographies, and so I had no intention of writing about this miracle, but I had chronicled a spiritual journey I'd taken from the time when I went through, went from rock bottom after the Bob Knight affair to discovering that I wanted to change my life and all of that, and so I'd written about 200 pages, and I actually put the book away and thought, oh, I'll just see what happens with the remaining time I have on the face of the earth and see if there's an ending here. And then about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, this miracle occurred that permitted me to finish the book. I had so many wonderful comments about what had happened and the struggles I'd gone through and all of that that I thought, hey, maybe it's time to finish the book and try to inspire some people. I talked it over with my new family, and they agreed, and so I went ahead and finished Road to a Miracle.
Wow, and it was a truly inspirational book, too, and it did follow a spiritual journey. What I thought was really interesting, though, and what I really enjoyed the most was the relationship that your parents had with you. I mean,
well, you know, yeah, when I practiced law, when I was a defense lawyer, you know, I saw what you know, and that is that the kids who stay out of trouble have parents who care about them. The kids who get in trouble have parents who don't. And that was one of the frustrations I had with practicing criminal defense law, being a trial lawyer, and one of the reasons I finally gave it up. It's because it was just so tough to see these kids who'd never really had much of a chance. Their father might be in prison, or their mother had run away, or whatever it might be. And you defend those kind of people day in and day out, those kids, and you just think to yourself, you know, that's just a crime in itself. And so my parents, you know, were the best. They were always there for me. They didn't judge me. They just tried to guide me along. And so I've always been so incredibly thankful for how they treated me. And one of the nice things about writing this book was to say some nice things about nice people. Mm-hmm. And I could tell people about the kind of parents that I had.
Well, they seemed to be so wonderful in as not only role models as parents, but bearers of great wisdom. I mean, wonderful pearls of wisdom that they passed down to you and that you shared in your book, as well as you mentioned, acceptance of you, but also others. To show empathy.
Yes, I think they saw right on that my brother was the intellectual in the family and I was the free spirit. And that's what's caused me throughout my life to try all kinds of different things. I tell young people, you know, go out and give it a shot to see what's going to happen. Maybe it won't work out like you thought it would, but something else will come along. The good Lord, the spirit that guides us, has many things in mind for us. And that's one of the things my parents taught me, was to be that kind of a person who wasn't going to be afraid to try things, but also with other kids that were around and young people, they were good in guiding them as well. Mm-hmm. You know, many times we'd have kids over to our house who didn't have the greatest parental care, and my dad and mom were kind of like step-parents a little bit and tried to guide those kids as well.
What I really liked, though, is they didn't tell you you couldn't try something. You even got to go to college as an engineer like your brother, but then when you decided, no, this isn't for me, they said, we knew you weren't that, but, you know, you go ahead and try it. So.
Exactly. I was with a person who's a physics professor the other day, and I had to tell him that when I went to Purdue and wanted to be an engineer, I took first year physics and actually got a 5 out of 100. A 5, and called my father and was crying. I'm terrible. I'll never make it. Anything. He said, you know, Mark, we knew you'd never be an engineer. Now get into something that you can do. And so I think that's another thing that parents can do with kids, is we're all going to fall off the table. We're all going to have those times when we're not going to be successful with something. And hopefully parents are understanding about that. They don't put too much pressure on them. Mm-hmm. And hopefully young people then are inspired by their parents doing that.
Right. And, you know, they allow their children to make mistakes. And I think a lot of parents don't allow their children to make mistakes, or not even mistakes, but having learning opportunities, if we could reframe it that way, as to trying to figure out who they are. They try to protect them too much.
And you have to be patient. I would think you would agree. You need to be patient with kids. I cringe when I see that kids, unfortunately, so many of them are put on drugs to settle them down or whatever else it may be these days. Sometimes you just have to be patient. I know with my stepdaughter, and we can talk about that in a minute, but there were times when, you know, she was just going through her growing pains, and she'd say something to me or her mom, and we both would just kind of walk out of the room before we responded, because we knew she didn't mean it, and we just wanted to let it go and use patience with her, because it took her a long time to like herself. A boy finally showed some interest in her and some other friends, and, you know, it was tough for her growing up because she had triplet brothers who got all the attention. Mm-hmm. And so we were just patient with her, and by golly, after a while, she found herself.
Now, to get to the step family, you went through a long journey yourself.
I did. Just quickly, there were several defining moments to this occurring, and there was a grand plan here that I couldn't see that wouldn't work. I had been in the entertainment business. I had done television, radio, been a newspaper publisher. I'd done all kinds of different things, but finally I left Hollywood and moved back to the Midwest, where I met a woman who was going through a divorce and had 4 children, including three boys, triplets. Mm-hmm. They were 8 when I met them, and the stepdaughter, 10. I married her. I lived in southern Indiana on a ranch. I had a radio show in Bloomington, Indiana, where Indiana University is. I had a wonderful family, mm-hmm. Successful author. I had it made, and then I blew it. And basically, I kind of call it fame addiction. What happened to me was that I just got too big for my britches. I was appearing on ESPN at times. I had this radio show. I was very, very critical of Coach Bob Knight and the way that he conducted himself at IU. And I think the good Lord just said, well, listen, if you want to keep yelling about him being fired at Indiana University, that's what will happen. You'll get what you want. And one of the parts in the book that you probably read is that out of 40,000 kids at Indiana University, he grabbed my stepson. He called me his most vitriolic critic. I was the main critic of Knight. And then somehow or another, the spirit that decided to collide, he and I, caused that collision. As you may recall, the boys couldn't go back to school. Knight was ended up getting fired. And I got death threats. I got terrible comments about myself. But I got so wound up in it that I made the first mistake a parent can never make, thinking more of themselves than they do of their children. Mm-hmm. And I like the notoriety. I like being on television. I like yelling and screaming about Knight. And it caused a real rift with my wife. Ended up with a very, very messy divorce where I lost contact with my stepfamily. And I really hit rock bottom at that particular point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your stepfamily, I mean, you really write a lot of wonderful things about them, and it seems like you had waited so long to get a family and had been through so much before you actually found the woman to marry that that must have been very devastating.
Well, it was, and you know, I'd always wanted to be a father, and that just hadn't happened. I'd moved around and been like this crazy fellow who tried all these different things and lived all these different places, so I just never settled down and never had was able to be a father. But I was able to be a stepfather for 12 years, and I loved it. I love those kids as my own. I mean, we don't give enough credit to stepfathers and stepmothers who step in and take over where there are problems and love the kids as their own, and that's what I did. And so when I lost contact with them, I had to look in the mirror and say, wait a minute, well, first of all, you blame them, you blame everybody for your problems, and I went through that, and then I thought to myself, look, it's not them, it's me. Mm-hmm. I've got to change myself. I didn't like the person I saw in the mirror, and then there were these steps that took me through a spiritual journey. The first one was the Bible. Reading about James and Job made me stop and think and say, hey, listen, if those guys can get through tough times, so can I. Mm-hmm. And then a book called The Purpose-Driven Life. I don't agree with everything that's in it, but that book's first five words really made a lot of difference to me. The first five words are, it's not about you. Mm-hmm. And so I started to kind of think, hey, I want to change myself, and I want to do some things differently. And so that book made a lot of difference. I ended up leaving the Midwest and moving back out here to Colorado where I'd been before. And finally decided, look, maybe I want to know more about this spiritual end of my life, and you'll like this. I called a seminary in California and said, do you let old people in with bad grades? Because
that.
I got terrible grades at Purdue and terrible grades at IU Law School, and this woman, God love her, said, well, we might. And that led to 2.5 years at San Francisco Theological Seminary, which just changed everything for me.
And I do want to talk about that, too, but just to go back a few years, I mean, growing up, your parents, I believe, went to two different churches, but you had a spiritual foundation in the beginning with your
mom. And I just lost it. I just lost it all. We were never much organized religion, but I had a spiritual guidance about me. I had a kind of a spiritual way of my feeling like that this higher power that was guiding me through all these wonderful experiences was beside me. And then I just got all caught up in the fame business. And, you know, to be a talk show host, to be on television, you must, you must be controversial. You must be judgmental. You must yell and scream. And I did that. And I just lost that spiritual foundation that I had.
So, I mean, it's hard to find it again if you never had it to begin with, I think. But I there was a quote that you had written in your book that your mom said, respect those who believe as you do in the higher power, but also those who don't.
Well, yes, God love her. You know, we had some people in our town that were so-called different. You know, they may have been gay, they may have been black, they may have been a minority, other minority of some sort. And Mom always said, respect those people. And it was the same way with regard to their beliefs. Mm-hmm. They may be people who go to church every Sunday and they're the best Christians in the world. They may be an atheist who doesn't go to church but acts in many ways like a Christ-like person of some sort. So that respect, and you know, you've hit a hot button for me because that's something that we're in trouble with these days. respect for others who don't believe the way we do or don't look like we do or whatever it may be. And that's a troubling situation. But my mom taught me early on that, that's no way to live.
Yeah, and I think that respect is really, really, really important for parents to teach their children, because they teach their children through role modeling that.
And our know as well as I do that, the kids soak up everything their parents are doing. They're like sponges. And so, you know, if you are a parent and you project those kinds of ill will towards people or bias or prejudice or whatever, they see that, and if their parents are doing, then it must be okay. So I'll tell you what, that's pretty close to child abuse in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, I think society needs to give our children a little bit more faith so they have something to fall back on.
I coach a fourth grade basketball team, then a fifth grade YMCA team, and now fourth grade again this year.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I can see with each of the kids that I have what kind of parents they have. Some of them just drop them off for practice and never show up. Some stay there for the whole practice. You see the reflection of children in their parents, and I get such a... It's so troubling at times when you hear parents yell and scream about their kids not behaving or getting in trouble or whatever else it may be. Well, who do they have to blame for that? Because those kids, they need guidance. They need love. My parents were always there for me and showed me the love that I needed. And that's something that unfortunately is missing with many parents and their kids these days. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is to remind fathers and mothers, but fathers especially, what a gift it is to have a son or a daughter. And then respect that gift and spend time with those kids. All the money in the world won't make any difference. It's the time they want.
Right. And I think your father did a wonderful job as a role model for you, not only being a great, sound, you know, he just seems so wonderful. Wonderful man for you to grow up with, you and your brothers and sisters, but also your stepfamily. And because your father remarried after your mother mm-hmm. passed away, and I believe he had five more children then, and he was a wonderful
That's
stepfather
right.
as well.
Yes, and, you know, I've met, you read in the book, I've met many famous people in my life. I've dealt with all of them, the Jack Nicholson's and Jimmy Stewart's and John Denver and Joan Baez and Neil Armstrong and many of those people I have great respect for. I met the good, the bad, and the ugly in the entertainment business, but I'll tell you, there's no man in my life that I respect more than my father. He wasn't famous. He was just a man who worked hard, took care of his family, and tried to guide me through those years when I needed him so much, and that's what I'll always love about him.
Yeah, and you mentioned famous people that you've met, too. One that I just love that you talk about is Mr. James Stewart.
Yes.
He's someone I always thought was just so down to earth. And was he that way in real life as he comes across in the movies?
Well, people will read that when I was living in L.A., I was appearing on television most of the time. I had a CBS show and then with Good Morning America and all of that. And then I went to a Beverly Hills Presbyterian church for a while and came up with an idea for a program about the stories behind the songs of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And James Stewart every year read the story of Christmas in that church. He was a member there. So I took my idea to the minister and then to Mr. Stewart and was about as nervous as I could be, because I asked him whether he would host a program that would focus on the church and also on these songs. And he said yes. And I'm just so blessed to say that he's a friend of mine. I have a photograph over here of him and me and Burt Reynolds that's very special to me, and I have some notes from him. He had the same sort of humbleness that I found in Neil Armstrong when I had a lunch with him. I saw that no need to brag, no need to project himself or try to be a big shot or anything. He was a very, very humble man. And during the filming, at one point, I was called out. They said he wanted to talk to me. And so I went out and talked to him for a few minutes and thought, oh, my gosh, something's wrong. He's upset. What's happening? And all that. And I went out and he asked me, he said, hey, is there anything I can do to help?
Hmm.
And so it was that kind of attitude that he had that was so special in Mr. Stewart.
And I think that comes across not only in his movies, but also as a role model for other people, asking, what can I do to help?
Yeah, I've pretty much made it a part of my spiritual being. I didn't want to become a minister at seminary after I went there. I studied theology, but we're all ministers every single day. Mm-hmm. And I try to make it a practice of whoever I meet just saying, hey, what may I do to help you? What's going on? Because we never know who we're running into, and especially with kids, young people, they may be going through a real tough time. They may be reluctant to say anything, and you'll be surprised if you do that, the responses you get. Because we may see the person down the street who lives in the big house and has the wife and kids and a big job and all that. That man may be absolutely miserable, and we never know it because he won't show it. But if we reach out and say, hey, how may I help you? He may say, you know, I'm in trouble. I'm drinking too much, or I'm this, or I'm that. And we are all ministers. We don't have to have the degree or be ordained or anything. We can just help people. You know, my wife and I went by the other day. There's a Firestone dealership here, and a woman was standing out there with one of those signs, waving it back and forth, you know, tire sale today, probably making about $10 an hour, and it was absolutely a downpour with rain. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, my wife, and I said, let's take our umbrella back for that woman. And so we turned around and went back and drove there and gave it to her. And she had the biggest smile on her face. And, you know, it was just easy to do, automatic to do, because we could tell that, you know, God bless her, she was out there trying to work and make a living somehow or another, and we could do a little something to help her.
Yeah, it's just reaching out and doing the small things. It doesn't have to be grand gestures, but just the small things.
Yeah, and especially with kids. You know, I see that in the kids that I coach. You know, you have 10 fourth graders on your team. You're going to see 10 different personalities, and you're going to see 10 different sets of parents, and you're going to see 10 different outlooks on life. And so they're all looking at you as a coach and trying to figure out, you know, what can I learn from this person? And I'm trying to think, what can I teach them? Basketball is the least of it. Sure, I want them to get better. Sure, I want them to have a lot of fun and everything. But, you know, team games and everything else, you can have an influence on those kids at that age. And many great athletes later on say, you know, that they got some good teaching or some good inspiration from a coach early in their life.
Mm-hmm. And I think that coaching, though, also goes back to you being a father or stepfather.
Well, you are in some ways a stepfather, and some parents look at it like that. They want just basically the coach to be a babysitter for a few hours so they can get rid of their kid. I'm sorry to say that, but that's what happens. So, you know, I learned from my father about that. You have trouble telling a 10 or 11-year-old kid or in the teenage years, you know this, what to do. But you can influence them by, you know, using examples or trying to be fair with them, to watch what they're doing, to try to guide them along a little bit that way. And so those were things that I learned when I was a young person.
Yeah, and when you're a little bit older than a young person, but younger than you are now, I remember reading your book. I love the story that when you're talking about your stepfamily, I know the first place you met your future stepchildren was at Chuck E. Cheese, and you talk about that. And but also when Kimberly, the daughter, as you had mentioned, was one of the most rebellious teenagers, defiantly told you, I'm going to a Grateful Dead concert in Michigan instead of asking for permission. And you just calmly said, you know, would you like to use the van?
It's like, well, you never know. You know, you don't know what brings those things to your mind at the time. You know, this sequel to the novel I'm writing now, I'm amazed at the things that pop into my mind from the past. Charles Dickens, I was just reading a biography, and he said we write from half from our imagination and half from our experiences. But why do certain things pop into our head? If we do have a good spiritual foundation, I think, and we are constantly thinking about the other person more than ourselves, then good things do come into our mind. And when Kimberly just walked up defiantly and said, I am going to a great Grateful Dead concert, she looked at her mother and I like, I know you'll tell me no, and then I'll pout, and then we'll have this and that. And instead, for whatever reason at that moment, it came into my mind just to say, okay, take the van. And that was one defining moment in her life, I think. She told me later that really showed her that we could trust her.
Mm-hmm.
And so then a boy showed some interest in her, and then Kimberly trying to kind of climbed out of the shadow of having triplet stepbrothers and became more of her own person. And one thing she did, by the way, she shocked us by going out for the softball team and became the catcher. And so, you know, just that little incident, for some reason, we never know what it can mean to somebody. Just a few words or a pat on the back or whatever can mean everything to a young person.
Absolutely. And you know, as you said, you don't know what's going to come out of your mouth either. And you just told her to take the van. Most parents would go, no, you're not.
Yeah.
But that is an issue of trust. And when teenagers are trying to become independent people and find out what their boundaries are and what they can and can't do, they really want to know that you trust them to make the right decisions and do the right things.
Well, I think so, and in so many instances, I see where parents put so much pressure on their kids. You know, we went to a California football game a few weeks ago, and my wife and I, it was just a great game, and we really enjoyed it. And yet, nobody talked about the entertainment value of the game, the camaraderie, the friendships, the fun, all of that. It was about the fact that Colorado didn't win.
Yeah.
We're so much into winning and losing and all of that these days that we miss out on what it's all about. And, you know, I tell parents the first day when I begin coaching, this is not about winning and it will not be. If you are really wanting this to be about your son or daughter winning a championship, I want you to get another coach because I won't work toward that. I'll play all the kids. I'll play them the equal amount of time. We may get beaten. We may this. We may that. But what I want them to learn is all the good things about being a team player. And that's where these days, unfortunately, this winning and losing gets in the way of all of that.
And it's so sad. I know I used to go to a lot of high school basketball games and some junior college games, et cetera, because I wanted to be a referee. But I used to sit up in the stands and watch the referees work. But I'd be sitting there surrounded by these parents that had so much. It was almost like life or death riding on this kid getting the shot or a foul being called or winning the game. It was not a pleasure to sit there and listen to these parents yell and scream at their kids and bitch and moan and say bad words. And it wasn't fun.
Mm-hmm. No, and it just puts such tremendous pressure on kids. On the baseball team I had, there was a former minor league player's son who played for us. And, boy, that kid, you know, so much pressure. I could see him, the stress on him when he went up to bat, that, you know, I've got to do well for dad and or mom or whatever it may be. And that's not what it should be all about. Baseball, basketball, football, they're sports.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be sports, and they're not supposed to be about all that. But if somebody wants to see what it's all about winning and losing, they can read this book because I wanted to win. I wanted to beat Bob Knight, and I wanted him to get fired, mm-hmm. and he did. And I ended up losing my family, and he ended up losing his job. But I lost my family because I was so intent on winning. So maybe that's something that's in my mind even more because I know what it's like when you put all of your effort into just winning.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time you won't, and the repercussions can just really upset your life.
So how would you have done that differently, that whole situation regarding Bob Knight at the university and having him fired and everything else?
My first call was to the university. My second call was to Bob Knight asking for an apology. I should have reversed those. I should have gotten a hold of him and said, hey, what in the world happened here? Why did you grab my stepson? I knew that he was a time bomb waiting to go off. He'd had all kinds of problems at IU and grabbing, you know, he grabbed a player and just choked him and did all these things. I should have tried to work it out in private.
Mm.
But for whatever reason, I guess I thought that I should let the university know. And then the university kind of tricked me a little bit into my not realizing that they were looking for a last reason to fire him, and then the whole thing just blew up.
Yeah.
So, I made a bad decision and a bad choice, and I paid for it.
So one of the lessons learned is try to work things out amongst each other instead of just going over people's heads.
Yeah, you know, another example, I work with writers all the time, helping them to get published, a consultant and mentor people and all of that. And I had a fellow recently who wants to publish a book who got all upset about some things that were going on. And it was just unfortunate because I felt like if we could compromise on a few differences we had, I could go ahead and help him. And he didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to win. And so he didn't realize that I had an agent and a publisher available to help him with his book. He just got so upset that he ended up terminating the relationship. And so that was up to him. And I just wrote him a nice letter. And I said, you know, I know you realize, you know, I respect what you did here. And you really think you won, but you really didn't. And here's why. And I hope maybe in the future you'll look more at compromise. You'll look more at a way of working things out instead of being so... you know, our reactions are things that cause us a great deal of problems. How we react to something immediately says a lot about us. And many times we act with anger or frustration. Kids especially do that. And if we can stop that and just let a little time to go by and stop and think about things, we'll be much better off.
Oh. That is so true. And this is a good point to stop for a commercial break real quick. We are talking with Mark Shaw on Answers for the Family, who wrote this wonderful spiritual journey book called Road to a Miracle. It's in the bookstores right now, and we'll be back to talk more with our guest, Mark Shaw, in just a moment. Stand by.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back to Answers for the Family. I am one of your co-hosts, Dr. Melody Fox, and with us today is Mark Shaw, who wrote the wonderful book called Road to a Miracle. And Mark, welcome back to Answers for the Family, and we appreciate you so much for being here today and talking about this. And every week we have listeners email in questions they have for upcoming guests, and I do have a couple questions for you.
Sure.
And one is, my question is about your children and how they reacted when you rejected the glamorous lifestyle you were living and took a different path. Because when my father, who was a semi-famous musician, left that world when we were teens, our family actually got closer and were actually able to live a normal life. What was that like for you?
Well, that's interesting. You know, there's the pluses and minuses to all of that. I think my stepfamily really enjoyed the brush with fame that we had all the time, seeing me on television. They actually produced a couple films, and so they got to go to premieres. They really enjoyed a great deal of that. But on the other hand, that took me away from them many times, and that bothered me because those formative years, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 in there, are so important. And so I think they felt like that at times, you know, I wasn't around, even though I'd call every day and everything. As time went by, I was able to cut back on my travel and cut back on what I was doing. But also, you know, there are parents who have to travel, who have to be away. And that's just part of the job, especially these days when jobs are so hard to get. So what I suggest to them when I talk to them is that that time they're going to spend with them, you make sure that it's the best it can be. You do things for them. If I could, I'm not a violent person, but if I could and I saw parents walking with their kids or at games or something, I'd like to take their cell phones and throw them in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of those. You know, don't sit and have dinner with your kids and be on the cell phone or talking to other people or doing things. Spend that time with them because They want you. They want your time. They want to know that they're loved. They want to learn from you. They want to tell you about the exciting things that are going on in their life and all of that. Mm-hmm. So even if you do have somebody who's famous or has to travel or whatever it may be, there's still time to find that good quality time with those kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you mentioned the cell phone thing, I was just thinking that yesterday. I was watching a young woman pushing her baby carriage, sitting there talking on the cell phone, and the baby's just like looking around like, oh, whatever. And it just seems like what a great opportunity it would be to have the carriage where the baby is facing her and her talking to her baby and actually paying attention to the child and interacting with the child a little bit more. She seems so disconnected on her cell phone. It was ridiculous. And then we wonder why our teenagers walk around disconnected from us, because they're glued to their phone.
Well, you've come up with a great word, disconnected. That's exactly what occurs. We probably should tell people, basically, you know, once I went to seminary, I was ready to fall in love again, and I did with a wonderful Taiwanese woman, a librarian at CU here. And then, you know, about a year ago, I found out, as you mentioned, that I had a daughter and two grandchildren I didn't know. Well, then you realize that I'm coming from a point where I never, ever thought I was going to be a father.
Right.
My wife in the previous marriage couldn't have any more children. I felt like I'd never be a father. I would look at fathers and mothers with their kids and be envious, I must say, of that, but figured out the spirit that was guiding my life, just that wasn't going to happen. And then this gift of a lifetime came around through some, as you know, as you'll read, very unusual circumstances, where I found a daughter and two grandchildren I never knew existed. So what a gift for me, but I look at it differently now, because I never thought it was going to happen, and it did. And so I just, you know, every single day count every single minute that I have that I can spend with my new family, with the kids, with the grandkids, because I look at it in a fresh way, because I never thought it would happen. It just means so much more to me. And so I try to tell people, you know, when you read this book, hopefully you'll see that you are blessed with having a daughter or a son or a grandchild, whatever it may be. Spend that time with them. Savor that fatherhood or motherhood, because it's one of the most special things that will ever be in your entire life.
Oh, absolutely. And that's so wonderfully put. And when you were talking about fatherhood and all that, I'm sure you learned a lot about being a father and grandfather for others. And you're also a big brother, I wanted to point out. You were a big brother to a couple children through your early years as well. So what a wonderful role model that was for them and for you, actually, to have that opportunity. But when you did decide to go to the seminary and you began to study the teachings, there was a famous Catholic monk that you mentioned in your book, Thomas Merton. And what did he teach you? What drew you to him so much?
Well, the first year in seminary, I had a spiritual direction class, and I'd never heard of Thomas Merton, a famous Catholic monk, as you said, wrote 60, 70 books in the mid-20th century. Was the most famous monk in the world at the time. And, you know, I started being interested in him because he was more of a spiritual type person. I didn't feel like I was still this organized religion guy, but I wanted to learn more about the spirit. And so I started reading his books, especially one that I would recommend to everybody, New Seeds of Contemplation. And he advocates the contemplative life of stopping and thinking, of contemplative talking, contemplative listening, becoming a better person in terms of reflecting on what you're doing from day to day. But the biggest lesson in New Seeds of Contemplation was, if you really want to change your life, you need to empty the garbage you have inside you. And that, for me, was the fame addiction, gotten off the track in terms of what was important in my life and all of that. And so by reading the Merton words, I started to say to myself, okay, it was going to be a gradual change, but I was going to become the Mark Shaw that I had become, that I had been earlier in my life. And so that made a great impact on me. I ended up writing a biography of Thomas Merton that was published a couple years ago. But that was another stepping stone to getting myself in a position and a mindset where I would be able to enjoy the blessing of finding a daughter and two grandchildren. My daughter was giving an interview, and I love to say that, my daughter, recently, and she said, you know, it took my dad 65 years to get his act together so I could find him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably true. If I had met her earlier in life, if I'd have known about her earlier in life, maybe I wouldn't have been in the same situation. But the spirit that had guided me took me through seminary, permitted me to fall in love and have a wonderful woman who would understand when we learned that it might have a daughter and two grandchildren, and then to find them. So it was all a master plan there, and Thomas Merton was a big part of that.
Well, you talk about finding your daughter and her saying it took you 65 years to get your act together so she could find you. But tell us what happened in April 2010 when you received an email from this unknown man in Minnesota named Jim.
Yeah. Well, one morning, sitting right here, I looked at the email, and this man had emailed me a couple times. He said I was a fan of my books, and I was so pleased to hear that because so many people don't like my books. They're kind of stop-and-think books, controversial books, and so I was pleased with that. And then he wrote back and said, well, did you happen to live in Minnesota in late 1968? If you did, my wife's mother thinks she might know you. And so I was a little bit suspicious of what he said, but I said, yes, I lived there right after Purdue for a period of time in Minnesota and all of that. And so just dismissed it as just an inquisitive question from him. So then the next day, the shock came, the thunderbolt came, when he said, listen, I need to lay out my cards on the table. I went to Google looking to find out how to publish a play that I'm writing. And I put in how to become a published author, and your name came up. And I saw it, and it sparked an interest because my wife had been adopted at age six months, had found her birth mother a few years ago on the East Coast, thought her birth father was dead because in the adoption file it said he died in a motorcycle accident. Her stepmother said, no, your dad isn't dead. His name is Mark Shaw, and he's a lawyer practicing in the Midwest. And so they tried to track that man down, and they never found him. They gave up the search for a while, and then James said, I looked in Google, found your name, went to the website, and the first thing I noticed was the gap in your front teeth, because that's what my wife has. Then I went to your Wikipedia page, and I saw where you were about the right age in 1968 to have had a child. And he said, I put two and two together, and I actually taped half of my wife's photograph, her face, with your half of your face. And they match exactly. And Mr. Shaw, I think my wife is your daughter.
Wow. I'm just sitting here just in awe. What, I mean, how does this happen? And how inventive Jim was to even put the pictures together. Who would have thunk to do that?
Well, he did, and I just had goosebumps even talking about it more than a year ago, because I looked at that screen and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, and I'll even get a little teary-eyed about it now, because it was like, watch, you know, and I read it and I read it again and again, and then I had to wait till my wife got home, and she asked me what I wanted for dinner, and I said, well, you better come over to the computer first. So she looked at it, and he had sent us two photographs, one of him and Marnie, who's my daughter, and one of her with her adoptive family. Mm-hmm. And Lou looked at those photographs and said, wow, my gosh, she looks like you, to summarize. And I said, well, I think that's my daughter, with tears streaming down my face. We hugged and everything, and then we had to figure out what to do, because he had said, you don't have to do anything. I don't expect anything from you. But there was no question that we were going to respond. We did, and then over a period of time, we exchanged emails, and then at my age, I went into a laboratory here near my home and took a DNA test. The woman kind of giggled when I said I was there for a paternity test. But the DNA was one of these 99.999 things, and confirmed that she was my daughter. I then learned I had two grandchildren, Allison and Lucy, 10 years old and 18. And 2 days later, Marnie and James drove 13 straight hours from Minnesota, and I hugged my daughter for the first time.
Wow. So tell us some new experiences you have enjoyed with your new family, because literally this is a new family. We're talking just a little over a year ago.
Yes, and every day is new. When I even think to myself, I'm going to go home and call my daughter, or somebody will say, "How's your daughter?" Or, you know, my grandchild, Allison, of all things, decided to go to Purdue, so she's there now. Mm. All of these things are brand new, and it's like I have a glow inside every day with this incredible feeling of being a father. What other emotion can you have in your life that is stronger than having a daughter or a son? When I see people taking that for granted, I want to yank them away and say, cherish that blessing, because we've gone through now the first Thanksgiving and the first Christmas. Sometimes we just sit around and look at each other because we still can't believe it's occurred. It's like a fantasy in many ways, but it's real. And so, when I'm with my daughter and the two grandchildren, it's just like I just glow. I think people can see that in me, that it's, the gift of a lifetime.
Wow. Wow, it absolutely is. And, you know, I have another listener question because we try to get them all on.
Sure.
But this one kind of takes us in another direction. But as an avid Hoosiers fan, I think we all tolerate Knight's behavior because he was so successful. But honestly, I felt he was entirely too theatrical in his outbursts. He had a reputation for insisting his athletes attend class and pursue degrees, and the graduation rate of his players was always high. Was this actually true?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, it is true. Nobody, all this stuff with black and white with regard to people, and I don't mean that in a racial way, whether they're good or bad. Nobody is all good or bad. There's some gray in there, obviously. And Knight was a great coach, and he had a lot of success in the 90s. But in the 2000s, as we approach the 2000s, he was this time bomb, as I say, and he didn't treat kids with very much respect and all of that. What have I learned from that this woman or man might take away? You need to watch your behavior because it all comes around. And I had to go through the first part of my life that was all these adventures. Then I had the step family. Then the nightmare came along. There's no question. Again, out of 40,000 kids, he grabs my stepson. That was meant to be. Mm-hmm. Then I had to go through a time when I could get my spiritual foundation back, fall in love, and have this miracle come around. So I went through difficult times and found a way out of that. Unfortunately, the coach has never gone through that. He still will never apologize for anything. He's still the loudmouth that he was. Nobody will give him a chance to coach anymore. He's a very unhappy person in many ways. So you can choose your path when something bad happens to you. And I sent him a book. I sent him a letter. I asked him to forgive me for what I did during that time, as I have forgiven him for what I did. Because, as you know, forgiveness is a big first step to moving on.
Oh, yeah.
And, I've never heard from him. I probably never will. But I said, I hope you get a chance to coach again. I hope you can be the teacher you were in the 90s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to turn my life around and have this miracle occur. At some point, I hope he can make a choice that will bring him back to something more than he is. But I can't do anything about that. All I could do was reach out to him.
Absolutely. And Mark, we only have about a minute or so left, but I was wondering, from your opinion, what can people expect to learn from this wonderful book, Road to a Miracle?
Well, I do like to say keep the faith, because you never know when there's a miracle right around the corner. The darkest days, when so many people are out of work, so many people are confused with what's going on, just keep the faith, and keep trying and keep going out there. There's a spirit that guides us all, and if we're willing to go that extra step many times, we just can't imagine, what can happen. So never give up and just keep going, and I hope that's one of the lessons that'll be learned from the book.
Well, I have to say it was a wonderful reminder for me as well, because we all have times of doubt, and to remember to keep the faith, I think, is really important. And I think it's really important for your children, for you to have an opportunity to teach them about having faith in something other than themselves, because that will help give them a foundation for later on as well, and support, that extra support.
Well, absolutely.
Well, I do want to thank you so much, Mark Shaw, for joining us today. And if anybody's interested in your book, where can they find your book, Road to a Miracle, and your many
other books? Well, most people seem to buy it on Amazon these days. For $10, you can pick it up there, and it is in some of the in many of the bookstores, but BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon, and they can also, if they'd like to see a few photographs of the new family and everything, that's at MarkShawBooks.com.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you again, Mark Shaw, for being on Answers for the Family. We thoroughly enjoyed talking with you, or I did at least, and definitely I'm going to get to that last chapter because I want to read the last part. And thank
you.
Thank you again, and have a wonderful life with your wife and your new family and your old family.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Bless you.
Bye for now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.